5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
The following is intended only for mature audiences. Discretion advised.
Where do the dead belong in the world of the living? For this newest spawn, moments of peace never come. His memories are fragments of the life he once had. For a hellspawn, memories replay his soul's own personal hell.
Hey, you don't have to speak up, Adam. Want to be heard?
Let's rock. Welcome to Spawnometer. My name is Mr. Fixit, and today I'll be interviewing Mr.
Diablo Frank. You're not interviewing me, motherfucker. We're just going to talk about some comic books. What the fuck? McLaughlin Lear Hour or something like that?
Comic books.
Spawn comic books. This episode, where he's going to focus on Chapel. Mac, in particular, has griped at us, and I think he's done it as a proxy for some of the listeners, that on a show called Spawnometer, we don't talk a lot about Spawn. And I come back and say, look, we talk about Spawn in every episode, but because he's in every episode, you're only going to get 20-odd minutes of it at a time. But there is some sense of a bait and switch where it's a Spawn show, and we're going to talk about what works. So every now and again, we will turn the show over to Spawn-related stuff. We can't talk about Chapel without talking about Spawn. We can't talk about Spawn without talking about Chapel. But we're going to start off with Chapel. Chapel was, of course, created by Rob Liefeld. I think that he was one of the late creations. A lot of the Youngblood characters were created years ago, you know, like 87 or so. They probably earlier than that, when Liefeld was still a fan. And you can tell when you look at the earlier Youngblood stuff how much Legion of Superheroes was an influence on it.
Avengers,
certainly, Titans. But as you get closer to the actual publication date, the newer characters are much more 90s. If you look at Chapel, to a large degree, he looks like a color-swapped Cable. Bishop, you know, kind of.
I thought he was more of like a Punisher.
I've always said that he looks like Bushmaster. Was the main villain of Moon Knight, if you read that book. Big, muscular dude who painted a white skull on his face. The hardcore, cold-blooded mercenary, where Mark Spector was also a mercenary, but he was confronted by the spirit of Chanshu, who I think was a pharaoh, and that triggered his multiple personality disorder. One of his personalities became a hero, and another one became like a detective, and another one was like a playboy. Because his consciousness was expanded and his number of consciousness was multiplied, he ended up running afoul of this guy he used to work with, and so this guy who used to be his best buddy became his arch nemesis, and the main guy that Moon Knight has fought for most of his career has been Bushmaster. I think Bushmaster was introduced in Moon Knight number one when they started the ongoing series in the early 80s, because I don't remember them getting that much into Moon Knight's backstory when he was just making guest appearances. And I know that Bushmaster went away for a long time there, but then he came back when they did the run that David Finch did. And I don't know if they've done anything with Bushmaster since Warren Ellis reworked the character a few years back.
Which I actually quite enjoy.
Yeah, I need to read some of that stuff. I kept seeing the solicitations for the Jason Burroughs drawn issues.
It's like if Batman went full insanity.
Right. Well, that's the way he's always been. Doug Mitch, sometimes I complain when they take a character and they go too far with them, they make them too weird and too edgy and stuff. But Moon Knight was basically conceived to
it
be...
I love, just real quick side, where he'll run outside and you'll see a street from the other character's point of view. And then when you look at it from Moon Knight's point of view, fucking pyramids are floating in the sky and the sky is orange and like there's a giant tit for a son. I mean, just weird shit. And that's how he sees the world. And it's just like, okay, I'm on board with this. I can do this.
There are characters that are designed to do stuff that where you can break the toys. They're made to be broken. Moon Knight is a toy that's made to be broken. But it's interesting because obviously Chapel wasn't created to be a villain for Spawn. I think that's something that was developed with the character as he went along. But it's funny because Spawn is a Batman-ish character, which means he's also a Moon Knight-ish character. And Moon Knight fights Bushmaster and Spawn fights Chapel. There's a lot of weird parallels there that maybe weren't intended, but come around full circle.
Okay.
Well, how much exposure have you had to Chapel? What have you read of that character?
He stabby people with knives and he has a skull on his face.
Okay. Is that all you got, though?
Pretty much an assassin. I'm telling you, dude, when I read what I read, I thought you didn't
read a lot of Liefeld.
Nah, I'm not a big Liefeld fan.
And there really wasn't that much Chapel in
Youngbloods that I can remember. It was all about Bad Rock and Die Hard and...
Well, I was going to say, because you didn't read most of that stuff anyway, I was saying you read Spawn, though. There wasn't really that much Chapel in Spawn.
Oh, no, not in Spawn, no. But for other stuff that we're reading, I did read some stuff off book just to kind of fill in the gaps with the stuff we're reading. Chapel had his own independent series.
We'll get into some of that stuff.
I have it on the side. I just kind of thumb through it just to kind of get an idea, because from what
don't get into that too much, though, because we're going to talk about that more later on.
Okay.
And you do know Chapel from the cartoon, too. It's funny because Liefeld had so many characters. We're going to see some of those characters finally show up in live action on Netflix, presumably live action. I don't know if they've said if the Netflix Liefeld deal is going to be live action or cartoon or what. I haven't heard anything about it. Since they were first announced, I haven't heard anything about it. So I don't know what's going on with that.
But it's not the Youngbloods. It's like all this other bullshit, right?
Right. And Chapel wouldn't be a part of that. But to date, the only thing that Liefeld has had adapted outside of comics was the very short snippet of Youngblood animation that they were using to help try to sell the property to TV stations that didn't work out, and Chapel, because Chapel was a regular character in the first season of Spawn. He turns up several times in Spawn season 2 and 3, and so you were exposed to Chapel. Probably your biggest exposure to Chapel was through the cartoon. What does he do in the cartoon? What did you see from him in the cartoon?
He's just a bad dude in the cartoon. I mean, he's the linchpin that started Al Simmons on his journey to hell. Because,
like, well, how are you introduced to Chapel? Can you describe the scene where Chapel actually first appears on the show?
Where
he's in a strip club in the cartoon.
Yeah, and all the boobs and some dude sitting there with a chick, and he grabs her tit to kind of prove it's his property, and Chapel,
she doesn't like it. She takes his hand off.
Yeah, Chapel grabs her and yanks her and walks her off. Now, at the time,
well, she's happy to be saved by him. She likes him. She doesn't like the guy she was with.
The next thing you know, he's banging her doggy style, and from what I can remember watching,
don't forget the guy that he took the stripper from.
Oh, he cuts
his
fingers off. Yeah, slices that. I'm telling you, he's a badass. He's the Punisher slash more rapey, I guess you could say. Kind of.
I don't know that he's really. That's the one thing that you could say is I don't think he's particularly rapey, because most of the chicks seem to be happy.
No. Okay, you're right. No,
he's a playboy.
He murders women like no problem. Like he kills
like Tony Twist is in bed with a couple of prostitutes, and just to send him a message, he kills both the prostitutes in the bed with him.
Yeah, just shoots him in the head like nothing.
Yeah, pretty cruel.
You get the very distinct feeling that if he were to go to hell, he would so be a spawn material.
He's not gonna have to get talked into going to hell by Mel Bolton. He's already on the way.
It makes you wonder, let's say Al had killed Chapel still, and Chapel became Spawn, what kind of book would that have been, dude? That would have been a true horror book. I think he would have, what do you call it,
reveled in it. Yeah,
just loved the shit. Al's torn between being a Spawn and doing what he feels he has to do and trying to recapture his past life. Like, he's all over the place, right? I think that would be kind of interesting.
Yeah, like, I think Chapel would be like, I'm a Hellspawn? Yeah, cool.
Fuck yeah. He'd be like, no, you're not cool. No. He'd be like, fuck yeah, about time. And I think he would kill all the Youngbloods.
Like, I was already a Hellspawn. I have these powers, all right, cool.
I think he'd be a killing machine. He'd be killing everything.
He's already a killing machine.
He would burn through his energy first 3 issues. He'd be done. By the end of that, he would have been spent.
That argument could be, well, I think he has a sense of self-preservation.
No, he would have been teleporting.
Oh, you mean
people.
He'd have wanted to go straight into be full blood head.
He probably would have gone after Mal Bolger. Easy. Mm-hmm. He would have been like, I'm king. So that's the interesting thing about it. Play him up as a serial, not even a serial killer. He's just violence. He's just violence incarnated. Yeah. He's just, from what I've seen in a cartoon that we've watched to what I've read in the books, wouldn't you even say he's kind of a strange fit for Youngblood?
I feel like
the Avengers, they would knock you out. I mean, let's be honest, Shaft would hit you with a fucking punching glove, you know.
Well, one of the things they make a point of in the very first issue of Youngblood is that they're interested in people with abilities and powers regardless of their moral alignment.
Yeah.
And Sci-Fire, of course, kills Kassam Hussein or whatever the hell they anagram they made of that. So obviously Sci-Fire is a psycho who gets off on killing people. They don't show that side of Chapel in the earlier issues, but as the series progresses, it becomes clear that he's a sociopath too.
Okay.
That's where the state prison is, where you were born.
Since we're going down this road, I want to make sure, let's go back to the very beginning, although it's actually the most recent Chapel comics ever published. Michel Fife came out with the 3-issue miniseries Bloodstrike Brutalists.
Mm-hmm. I still haven't read it.
You haven't read it yet. We're going to get to some of those fairly soon. One of the things that was fun about the project is he had backup features and additional materials that alluded to an expansion of the Extreme Universe that's not actually going to happen. He basically talked to a bunch of his indie comics friends to add value to the project by doing their little side stuff at the back of the book. He got Paul Mayberry, who's done a number of indie books, but he's probably best known. He was involved with, I think it was called Catalyst, where Joe Casey tried to bring back the Dark Horse Comics Greatest World characters in a maxi series.
I vaguely remember that series.
Yeah, and so Mayberry drew some stuff from that. I also knew him because he'd done a commission for me. He did the Devilman of Pluto for me years ago. Really nice piece. Put a lot of work into it. He spent all of a Friday doing that piece for me. But he also did a Chapel origin serial. I hesitate to call it a backup story because it's very, I don't want to call it, say, stream of consciousness, but it reads a little bit more like a newspaper strip. You know, when you take a newspaper strip and you've got like a little tiny segment of story,
yeah,
and it runs over a period of time and you have to kind of put it together in your mind over time what's happening. And because the story is told in 3 2-page sequences that jump around in time some, you really have to stop and think about what you're reading. It's a little bit challenging. So I want you to keep that in mind. I want you to read the backup strip right quick and then we'll talk about it.
Jesus. I was just a kid. Never thought this job would come to this.
What? You're gonna have to speak up, kid, if you want to be heard. It's not just a job, it's an adventure.
So we're introduced to Chapel as a young boy who's being
he's a scrawny kid in a mouse costume.
Apparently sick too.
Halloween 1978, if I remember correctly.
I think so. And he's being picked on by some other kids. One who happens to have his trademark skull on his face.
Yeah, this one kid in a hoodie, which I think maybe he was a little early for hoodies, 78. But anyway, but this one kid paints the white skull, and that's where he learns that technique. But the thing is, he had the white skull because it was Halloween. That's right.
They're beating the shit out of him. He's
stealing
rescued.
His candy.
Yeah, stealing his candy. They're telling him to thank his mom for the action. I guess that was a mama joke. As he gets home, his mother tells him that he's going to go stay with his uncle, which he doesn't want to. He's crying. She tells him not to cry. It's later revealed that the reason is because she's sick and she's passing away. She passes away and I guess he has to live with his uncle now.
Yeah, they call him Uncle Theo at one point and then later on he's called Uncle D. And what's the deal with the uncle too?
Is he molesting him?
I'm thinking that because there's a sequence where they show
where
him receiving communion.
Yeah.
Well, no, that's not his uncle. That's, hold on, we'll get to that. Okay. There's a sequence where after he goes to live with the uncle, they show him taking communion.
Yeah.
And it's very oral fixated panel. And the dialogue is referring again to the uncle. So I got the impression that maybe if there wasn't sexual abuse, I think there was emotional and physical abuse because it seems like he was really like a violent drunk, a crazy vet kind of dude. Because the dude that what is happening is he's being interviewed for the Young Project, is what they called it at that time. Mm. I think that's supposed to be the Young Blood Project. I don't know if that was a screw up in the lettering or if that was actually like what they was referred to in the earlier days. But somebody was calling him Stinson, and he doesn't want to be called Bruce Stinson anymore. He wants to be called Chapel. He's telling that guy, "You calling me by my government name? That's disrespecting me." So he puts a gun in his mouth. At that point, the time jumps to 1984, and they actually write 1984 down the barrel of the gun.
That's just pretty cool. But Chapel is seen as a bit of a loose cannon. In a little dangerous, and so the group that are putting this team together are a little concerned with that because they understand that the image of the team is very important. One of, I'm assuming, the generals pointed out is sometimes you need a sharp weapon, like, you know,
yeah, sometimes
machete,
you need somebody who
a bloody
can, yeah,
machete, yeah, to get the job done, and that's what he is.
Yeah, Chapel's nothing but sharp edges. It's actually Stone, who will later become Battle Stone, one of the founders and first leaders of Youngblood. They also make mention to the X7 serum, which will later become like this, like the equivalent of the Super Soldier serum, yeah, within the Youngblood comics. I don't know if they actually called it X7 in the original comics or if that's something they invented for this strip.
Because I don't remember them ever. I don't
they
know.
Might
we
have, though.
That.
You know, I've read a lot of Chapel stuff all at once, so I can't remember if I saw that being referenced in the Youngblood books or not. But it's supposed to give you superhuman strength, speed, and senses, from what I understand.
Was that Battlestone who confronted him? I was just a little lost at the end.
Well, like, okay, I think the time jumps again to 1990, and we see that Chapel's like hanging out with a bunch of prostitutes, and he beat up their pimp because he was being violent with them, yeah, and then he gets confronted by this villain called the Fist of the Bizarre.
Who has this giant iron mask on.
Yeah, and the giant hand, too.
Yeah, and he's beating up Chapel, and of course Chapel's kicking his ass, fighting back, pulling out guns, shooting him.
But what's interesting is the Fist of the Bizarre keeps saying things that would make you think that he's Uncle Theo or Uncle D.
Yeah.
Because he keeps referring...
As they're battling, there's one point where he's like, you know, a coward with his little guns. Are you all out? And he's like, who says I was out? He pulls out another gun, keeps firing to the point where...
It's kind of a joke that Chapel's like that kid from that video where they're trying to demonstrate how many weapons you can hide inside a big jacket. Yeah. And so he's pulling out like a billion different guns. That's how he rolls on a daily basis.
And again, he was covered in pockets. He had lots of pouches. All the pouches. Good job on that one. They're battling. He's firing. He's firing. Finally, the Fist of the Bizarre is on the ground. What are you going to do? Do your worst. And Chapel just starts basically curb stomping him over and over and over. And he tells him, what are you going to do? Kill him? And he's like, well, no, I didn't get paid for that. So, yeah, you get to live because I didn't get paid to kill you. And then later on, it's revealed that the Fist of the Bizarre was Stone. Mm-hmm. I guess testing him to see
if he was up to, yeah, because he was making a point of psychologically testing him. I think because they were aware of his dark history.
Yeah.
And I think it's alluded to that at some point in his teenage years, young Bruce Stinson killed his uncle over the abuses that he was suffering. The uncle was talking about how he was going to carve a man out of him with his knife. And I think that Stinson killed his uncle as a result. And Stone was trying to show that even when you're fucking with his head and bringing up all these dark memories, Chapel was still in control.
Yeah.
He was a lethal weapon, but he wasn't an absolute killer. He still had perspective. He's still like, no matter how much you fucked with him, he gets paid to kill. So that showed that he had control, that you couldn't fuck with him.
Yeah.
And that was their concern, is was like, maybe we may not be able to wrangle this guy. And he's like, no, he's a weapon. He's dangerous, but he still got his head straight.
His faculties about him. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was pretty much it.
It's a pretty decent intro, I think. It gives you some insight into why Chapel would be the way that he is.
Yeah.
So let me give you a little bit more backstory from the stuff that I've been reading. The timeline on Chapel between the various comics that he's appeared in is really fucked up. Because this story is supposed to take place in Halloween 1978 when we were first introduced to him when he's pre-adolescent. In the early 1980s, he takes part in Operation Night Strike, which is an expendable, disavowable special missions force for the U.S. government led by Agent John N.X. Stone, later to become Battlestone. Yeah. So it shows that that's how they knew each other is through Operation Night Strike. Al Simmons and Bruce Stinson were already running around together at that point in time. They were doing like some kind of urban vigilante thing where they were doling out street justice to gangbangers. When Stone arrived to recruit Chapel, a Colonel Troutman thing, I think, Chapel basically says, well, my buddy Al's coming too. So that's how Al ended up getting involved in all this covert stuff.
I think at one point, though, they even were like, man, why couldn't we have gotten his buddy? Like he would,
oh, to be in, yeah. In, yeah, talking well, because I think by that point, he was already famous. The Operation Night Strike is rounded out by a guy named Duke, who appears briefly in Youngblood Strike File. You've got Jake Dutch Holland, who later becomes Dutch, who's a member of Youngblood. And some dude named Freely, and I'm not sure if that's the guy who becomes Priest from Evangeline, but my understanding is that that character from those comics, the Extreme Studios or Maximum Press books, he was also part of Operation Night Strike.
I don't like hiding in goddamn closets.
Well, you're not supposed to be in the country, Chapel.
Isn't that the guy who married Al Simmons' wife?
As I was saying, we have to carefully position ourselves so that...
You know, he should thank me for freeing up a nice piece of ass like Wanda.
Let's focus. The guns, that's what this is about. Nothing else.
Not worried about the Boy Scout?
Terry's being monitored, just like everyone else.
Someone's got your weapons.
There's a leak somewhere. I need it plugged.
Just let me know when and where.
I want this mission executed with precision and finesse.
You trying to say I'm sloppy?
Overzealous, like our little South American project.
Not my fault those people don't know how to duck.
This time, it's on American soil. The rules are different. Cover your tracks.
Yeah, yeah, just call the ball so I can get out of your fucking closet.
Their first operation is a rescue mission in Afghanistan against Russian soldiers, where they're actually rescuing Cabot, who later turns up in the Bloodstrike team, the brother of Battlestone and the leader of Bloodstrike. Chapel becomes one of the CIA's most ruthless and efficient assassins. He has a seemingly limitless knowledge of weapons and hand-to-hand combat techniques. There's a story that's set in 1983, which shows that he's already the Chapel that we're going to see in the sequence where they're trying to recruit him for the Young Project. That story is chronicled in the 1995 two-issue micro-series. It involves Chapel going into Nicaragua with a group of mercs, which included one member named Billy Zane, which I thought was weird. They're going after a guy named Colonel Black, who's basically Kurtz from Apocalypse Now. And there's a lot of allusions to Apocalypse Now. The story even starts as a flashback with Bruce Stinson in the modern day watching a fan on the wall, and then it flashes back to 83. That was the book that I think you were talking about. It was extremely gory. There's one sequence where Chapel says, yippee-ki-yay, losers, which I thought was sad. They're fighting zombie contra scum. Basically, the Contras through this Colonel Black dude are being risen from the dead. The team of mercenaries that Chapel's leading is killing these guys off as best they can. Finally, it comes down to Chapel versus the Colonel, who has been possessed by a demon and has also turned to cannibalism. He was eating his own men there toward the end. Chapel manages to kill the Colonel, and of this mercenary group, there's only two survivors, Chapel and his then best buddy, Jeff Jackson, who I don't know if he pops up later on, but it's another African-American dude who was part of that group. Kind of like Predator, where you only had two survivors there too. That two-issue miniseries was written by Brian Whitten and Eric Stevenson. You may remember Eric Stevenson is now an Image partner, wrote the Infinity character, which we covered a little while back. Yeah. It was drawn by Tom Tinney and Calvin Irving. Tinney, you got to start working on companies like Comico, and he did covers for Fleetway Quality. He did some work on the Now Terminator series before Dark Horse got the rights. I think the main thing that people know him from is Forceworks. He did the first five issues, so I know Mac knows that one well. Did you read Forceworks?
I remember seeing it, but no.
Michelle Fife did a whole treatise on Tom Tinney and how much he loved Tinney's work and how groundbreaking it was. It was extremely ornate, but also really weird because he had this thing where he'd give everybody smush faces. It's like everybody didn't look like they had a nose that projected from their face. But he did all this weird, intricate line work that made all the characters crackle with this energy. But everybody looked like they were dark side or something, super wrinkled. But it was cool looking artwork. He didn't do a lot of work over the years, though. After Forceworks, he did three fill-in issues of Nightwatch, who was that Spawn knockoff character that Marvel did.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
He did an AC/DC comic, which I want to track down just out of curiosity, because there was a brief period in time where Marvel was putting out music comics. People remember the Piranha Press music that they did for a little while there, but nobody ever remembers that Marvel did that shit in the mid-90s, too, because that was that during the period where they were just putting out so much product. You never see those fucking comic books anywhere. But Tom Tinney fell off. He so turns up in conventions. I think he's actually a Texan, but I've never seen him at any shows or anything. Meanwhile, Calvin Irving did most of the seven issues of the Chapel ongoing series, but again, it only lasted seven issues, so it's practically a mini series. And he did a handful of other comics, but he didn't really did a lot. I do remember him, though. He did a story in Verotic, but he had a really weird style where it was very minimalist and very dark. You know, it suited Chapel well, though, which is probably why he got to do the ongoing series.
Come on, Amos. Tell me what you know.
Oh, Lord. I don't know. I don't know.
Look at that. Broken glass. Good as a scalpel. The guns. Our guns,
Amos.
It's not like you're protecting the family jewels. But hey, I could cut those off too.
So then we jump to 1984 when he's being brought into the Young Project, or attempted to bring him into the Young Project, even though it doesn't necessarily happen then. So then there's a story set in 1985 in Tehran, the capital of Lebanon. So it's obviously supposed to be Lebanon. And they speak Lebanese, but not Lebanese, Lebanese. So it's another one of those Qassam Hussein things where they're just barely hiding anything. He's tracking down this terrorist who's a poster boy for anti-American sentiment in the Middle East called Kustan Hakmed. And Chapel being Chapel, in 1986 he blew up the dude's house with his daughter inside. In 1988, he's supposed to become part of Battlestone's Youngblood, the earlier incarnation of Youngblood. But again, the timeline's all fucked up with Chapel because there are different books that contradict that. There's a story set in 1989, which was actually a one-shot from 1997 that came out from Awesome Comics, which didn't last very long. That was another one of Liefeld's companies. And that story, Kustan Hakmed buys stolen X7 formula to retro-engineer at home on a small island off the African coast. Chapel slaughters all of the dude's scientists, tortures the compound, then gets into a fight with Hakmed that ends at a standstill because Hakmed's taken some of the X7 formula. Eventually, Hakmed is killed when the evac chopper comes in and shoots him with Gatling guns. Chapel wants to go on a vacation, but they ask him to do one final assignment first, which was to kill his best friend. So supposedly, he was supposed to have killed Spawn in 1989. But the Spawn comics has him dead in 1987, so you can see where they're already fucking up the continuity there. And see, the funny thing, too, is because that takes place at Awesome Comics, I don't think they were actually able to say that it was Al because they didn't have those rights anymore.
They didn't have the rights.
So just
what name did they use?
I don't think they used a name. I think they just said, we want you to kill your best friend. And so the story was written by Robert Place Napton, who's done a lot of scripting for Extreme and Maximum Press, including Bloodstrike Assassin, when they turned the book from a team book into a solo series. Yeah. It was basically a Deathstroke knockoff. And he wrote the Chapel ongoing series as well. He went on to do a lot of the bad girls, like Evangeline, which explains the priest connection. He did Alley Cat, the comic book that featured Alley Baggett from Playboy. Yeah. He did Lady Pendragon. He did Deity, which was, I think, Carl Alstetter drawing that one. So you got this whole Homage press circle there, because Carl Alstetter started out as an intern at Homage Studios. And Wills Portacio says that he helped to develop the Bishop concept with him. Napton, he's still working. I would assume that a lot of these Image guys that you didn't hear about very much anymore just sort of fell off the earth. But he actually has done a bunch of work for Dynamite. He did the John Carter series. He's doing Deja Thoris. He did some of the classic Battlestar Galactica comics that Dynamite was putting out. And he joined John Stinsman with a lot of those Liefeld projects, especially Evangeline. That was a project they did together. I would think that'd be the thing he'd be best known for, since Evangeline had a pretty decent life in the Bad Girl era. But maybe other people know him more from other stuff.
Angeline,
they had that model that they hired, and they did all those photo covers, and she's like a warrior angel. She's basically Angela, but over at Liefeld's company.
I remember now.
The timeline's supposed to be 1990, where he's supposed to be fighting Battlestone, but that doesn't make sense because he was already part of Youngblood in 1988 in the Liefeld comics, so it's just a fuck up there.
Continuity, gentlemen. Keep up with it.
After Youngblood came out, in the early issues, Liefeld was trying to gauge who the most popular characters were based on the mail they were getting. And the three characters that got the most mail about asking for more backstory and just expressing excitement for the characters was Die Hard, Bad Rock, or Bedrock still back then, and Chapel. Especially Chapel is, I think, the way they put it.
Yeah.
So when they launched Solo Youngblood, essentially is what it was. It was a take on Solo Avengers. As a flip book, Chapel and Die Hard were in there, and the intention was that Bad Rock would come in later on, which did end up happening. But the initial issues, it was the flip book. One side was Chapel and one side was Die Hard. So we're going to go ahead and look at the Chapel material, since that material was advertised as a prelude to Spawn number 12 and 13.
You take off the lens cap? Wynn sent me to find you. Said you were going to be my albatross.
I think you call it a partner.
So you're the one took a bullet for a liberal. I guess that's dedication, all right.
The president's a president.
Is that right? In covert ops, maybe not always.
What's so funny?
I'm here because I killed the fucking assassin. You know, the one you let get away.
We're introduced to Chapel, Al,
reintroduced,
and
I suppose.
Duke.
Oh yeah, that's right. It's a flashback. We literally are introduced to him at the earliest point in that part of his career. I think it actually says that this is occurring 6 years back too.
So
Spawn had died 5 years back, so it's a year before Al Simmons dies, roughly.
Well, I guess
a year or two, because I think this came out in the second year of Image.
Well, we're introduced to Chapel, Al, and Duke as they're kind of a hit squad, I guess. Assassins for hire,
and they're sent to St. Louis to deal with Cybernet, which is not related to Cyberforce.
Were they?
There's too many cybers, man. So Cybernet was Rob Liefeld's Cyberdata knockoff, I think, roughly. Okay.
Androids, right? They're androids.
Yeah, they're like zomboids or something. I don't know. They're weird things. This was the first mention of Operation Nightstrike, I believe, too.
And see, I kept getting that mixed up, because then they'd come up with a comic book called Nightmare.
Yeah, that's a whole different thing.
Okay, for some reason I kept mixing those up.
Well, again, it was a running gag in the 90s that you take two nouns and smash them together and you've got a character. I mean, maybe we may need to point out too, since this is an audio medium, when we say Nightstrike, that's spelled with a K as in Dark Knight. Nightmare you're mentioning was also spelled with a K. So not to be confused with Nightmare, like an actual normal nightmare that you like at Marvel 2, the green dude. So it all gets very confusing. Yeah.
So they're sent in to kill, assassinate.
And it's worth noting, too, that the organization they're working for is called Central Intelligence. Not this Central Intelligence Agency mind, just Central Intelligence.
CI,
not CIA, supposedly. Right. But you can tell this is Liefeld's wannabe IO, the Black Ops organization.
So they were copying each other?
Basically, they're all copying each other,
wow,
too. Yeah. And they're going after a dude named Geiger, who is, the head of the Cybernet. And Cybernet, I think, was a cyborg terrorist organization or some shit like that.
Cobra.
They go to kill Geiger, but he isn't actually on base. They just have him on a giant monitor. And he makes a point about calling out Chapel's ghoulish makeup. And he has that ghoulish makeup at a point before Bloodstrike exists as a group, but they're already experimenting with like the zombified super soldier things, like bringing back the dead soldiers. And he's comparing them to the Bloodstrike project.
Diehard is basically a ghoul robot, isn't he?
No, I think he's just a cyborg.
Okay, but isn't he like in World War II or some shit? Like
he's an old cyborg.
Yeah,
but I don't think he was undead. You know, at this point he would probably need to be, but back then it was still plausible to have a really old dude still be alive from World War II.
I like the fact that we're trying to justify.
You're right, cyborgs from World War II.
Well, somewhere along the line, Duke gets killed.
Duke didn't get killed. Duke gets murdered.
Well, murdered.
Murked.
And
who does he get murdered by?
It's Chapel, right?
No, Al Simmons kills him.
I thought it was, okay. When I was reading, I thought it was Chapel that was shooting him. Okay.
You just read it, so yeah. Maybe I'm misremembering, but my recollection is that Al Simmons killed Duke.
Because Duke had gone crazy, right?
They said that Duke was a traitor, and yeah. they were like, this is what we do to traitors.
We follow orders, yeah. It kind of fucks with Chapel's head a little bit.
Does it?
I think so, because they bring it up again later on, because he really did see them as like three amigos type. Like, I think Chapel actually liked them.
Mm-hmm. As the three amigos? Yeah.
Jason Wynn.
Either Al or Chapel are asking him why they killed Duke, and Wynn's just like, he turned traitor. Yeah. You don't need to know the details.
Yeah, basically the same thing that's going to happen to Al. It's just Jason Wynn says he's a traitor, follow orders, do it.
Because that was a short story. That one,
they're all short.
Yeah.
Because the Chapel stories take place.
In my head, I'm already jumping to the part where.
If I remember correctly, the first story ends with a two-page spread where they took the ad that they were using as a promotional image, where it's just Chapel with a knife and gun and stuff looking crazy evil. And they use a computer, early computer alterations to shatter and warp the image of Chapel in the background. And then it's a close-up shot of Wynn talking some shit, if I remember correctly.
And then the second one starts with what?
Well, the second one's the one where they fight the cybernetic war dogs. And
because he's laying in bed banging a chick and he talks about the three shots.
Right, because that's one of the tricky things, too, is, I know what happens. So the first story is the flashback to take place before Al Simmons dies. At the end of that story, if I remember correctly, Jason Wynn tries to rehire Chapel to work with him after he'd left Wynn to go work at Youngblood. Okay. Chapel's like,
that's
fuck
right,
you, deuce.
Because he knows, because he says, I got something on you.
Yeah, I got shit on you. I don't have to come work for your ass anymore, deuce. And Wynn's like, okay, well, you think you're not going to jump through my hoops? Fuck you. I'm going to fuck your shit up. So he hires Geiger to assassinate Chapel. And that's when those cybernetic dudes come in there and kill the chick.
They kill the girl. He fucks them up.
Yeah, he's fucking a chick and they kill the girl.
The size of a tunnel. And it turns out that the war dogs are actually a messaging type device. Because one of the heads starts talking to him, talking about, hey, Chapel, meet me here at this place at this time.
Like the docks or some shit.
Yeah, and so Chapel decides, all right, I'm going to show up. I'm going to kill this motherfucker. He rolls up there. Geiger's there with two other guys, and he's telling them, do you know why you're here? Letting them know, look, I was sent to kill you. Chapel was chasing after Geiger. He stopped chasing after him.
Well, he was sent after Geiger 6 years ago.
Yeah.
And now, in the present, Geiger was hired to kill off Chapel or to fuck with Chapel.
And that's when Geiger tells him that Jason Wynn is like a virus. His power is spreading beyond his imagination or even Chapel's, and that they need to work together to take him out. And he promises him, look, I guess he's assuming he can get closer to him. You kill him, and I won't kill you right now. And Chapel's kind of like, fuck you. He kills his two guards, puts a gun to his head, and kills Geiger. And you find out it wasn't Geiger. Geiger's like, are you stupid? You think I'd actually show up to this shit? What are you, fucking moron? Chapel's pissed because he just found out that Wynn was trying to have him killed. So then the third story starts with Chapel being in a chair being injected. And Al sitting there.
It's another flashback to Al being alive, yeah.
And Chapel's talking about, hey, you really should get this stuff. Look at that. Look how great I look. And Al tells him, well, me and Wanda are trying for a kid, and I don't want him jacking me up with some shit. We don't know what's going to happen.
We don't know what Wynn's techno geeks are pumping into your...
And he's like, well, whatever it is, as long as I keep getting these effects. He goes, have you ever seen such a perfect specimen? And Al goes, every time I look in the mirror... That was a nice little dick.
Well, I think he was one of people's most beautiful men or
sexiest
men alive.
Or some
one shit.
Of the E stories. Yeah. Actually, yeah. You're jumping ahead, asshole. That's in 13.
No, Al Simmons was one of people's sexiest men alive before he died. Yeah, that was mentioned in like Spawn number one, if I remember correctly.
No, it was Spawn 13.
Why would they mention that in Spawn 13?
They do that. Okay. It's part of the little news thing.
Okay.
Anyway, Chapel's getting pumped full of his drugs. Then we return back from the flashback to the present time, where Chapel is confronting Wynn, and he's going to kill him. And just as about to kill him, Wynn tells him, number one, you're not going to kill me. Have you ever wondered what we were pumping you full of? And he goes, what do you mean? He goes, didn't you ever wonder? He says, you know, our techno geeks created this fantastic little virus for population control, but we found out that if we pump it in, we could actually set it up so that it would be activated, remote control.
It'd be dormant until activated, yeah.
And he's like, you know, and of course,
I done tested positive for the super AIDS.
We all know what he's hinting at, which I thought was kind of weird. You know, they're kind of, you know, using a real life crisis as kind of a...
Don't they come out and say that he's got the AIDS?
Yeah, he goes,
there's plenty of real things to be scared of, like super AIDS.
Super AIDS?
That's right. A new form of AIDS which is resistant to drugs. Just one teaspoon of super AIDS in your butt and you're dead in 3 years.
Ah! Oh, Jesus.
So now you feel better? Ghosts don't exist and there's nothing to be afraid of. Except for Super 8s.
He's like, I don't believe you, Wayne. What do you think? You're no Oliver Stone. You think I'm going to believe your conspiracy that I have HIV? And he goes, why wouldn't we? He's like, we found out it's perfect control. And so he goes, at this point, Chapel was like, well, fuck it. I got nothing to lose then. Before that, Jason Wayne tells him, like, you know, and I told Youngblood this, so as soon as you get back, they're kicking you out. So it's kind of like HIV shaming, which I thought was really weird.
Well, but there was a lot of HIV phobia, a lot of fear.
I remember
back
as
then.
A kid, yeah. There was a lot of phobia for that.
Ryan White says he gets very lonely. He misses his friends. The 13-year-old was banned from school after it was found he was suffering from AIDS, and now his school have said they never want him back in class.
But it was just weird to know, like, it something like that had soaked into even the comic book world. It was kind of crazy.
Well, I mean, okay, when did Magic Johnson come out as HIV positive? 91-ish,
95?
No, was it later than that?
In the 90s, between, I would say, 93 to 95.
But it was this announcement in 1991 that sent shockwaves through the sports world and beyond.
Because of the HIV virus, I will have to retire from the Lakers.
Somewhere around there.
I would say on the earlier side of that, because I when I was in school, I remember that was that came out.
I remember seeing it on TV where he came out and he did the whole thing and he told everybody. And I was like, what?
Because he still continues to play, right?
Jason Wynn basically tells him, look, you know, you can, you know, I've told you this, but there's no way anybody will believe you. We did it. We're just going to tell him, you know what? You run around a lot. You're very...
he's a known womanizer. They set that up in Youngblood 1. Yeah.
You're just crying, woof. So there's nothing you can do about it. And so at that point, Chapel's like, well, fuck it. I got nothing to lose. And he gets ready to try to shoot Wynn, but he goes, but... And there's always a but. He tells him, we have a cure. And Chapel stops. And of course, at that time, Wynn goes, I knew that would get your attention. And he tells him, that's right. We do have a cure. And we're willing to give it to you. But you're going to have to be our nice little lapdog. And as he's walking away, and Chapel's in there all pissed, he's calling the elevator for himself. And he tells him, you know where to find me. And then that's it.
Yeah. And then he leaves that book to go to be in Bloodstrike. He's no longer in Youngblood. He goes into Bloodstrike after these
stories.
That's
more the Corvort team, right?
That's the Universal Soldier team.
Yeah,
which we're gonna get to,
but that's not like Youngbloods, where Youngbloods is actually
those are two different. Those are exactly, you're right. So like the Youngblood are the over heroes of the government, and Bloodstrike is a covert blood wet works operation of undead soldiers and shit. So he ends up joining them for a little while.
Okay, and then that's where we left off.
So you said that you'd actually read those comics back when they first came out.
Vaguely remember reading one or two parts of that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the first two parts. I don't think I ever finished it.
What drew you to it, though? Because remember, that one had a foil-stamped logo or something on the Die Hard side. I don't think there was anything on the Chapel side.
I'm trying to remember. Somehow I got... That was, I guess, at the time I was collecting a lot of, like, everything that was coming out, Image. I was giving everything a try, like Brigade and that and Troll. I mean, I was just basically picking up the first 2 to 3 issues. I think the only things that I was sticking with that I collected on a regular basis was Spawn, Savage Dragon, not really Wetworks or any of the other books. I would pick up, just like I said, you know, Cyberpunk, whatever. I would pick up the first two, give it a try. If I liked it, I would keep going. If not, I would drop it. And I remember I read both stories and I was just kind of like, I don't care, and just never continued with it. But that's vaguely what I remember.
I'm trying to debate if I want to spoil this. There are at least two There are at least two Image properties where you have an African American character who has HIV, and I'm not sure which one came out first.
Both of them in Image?
Both of them were at Image Comics. So it's this.
I knew
really,
Chapel. I always knew.
Yeah, there's
one.
Another one too, but I don't want to reveal the identity just yet because I like to keep up the surprise if possible. I'm not sure which one happened first, and I've tried to applaud Image Comics for having African American characters and people more like ethnic variety in their comic books. But it's weird to me that two of the most prominent African American characters in Image Comics also happen to have HIV. That's problematic.
Well, let me ask you this: was it two competing artist writers, or was it this? Oh.
Yeah, it wasn't like both Liefeld or anything.
Okay.
Now, one interesting thing though in the case of Liefeld is I know you've watched the Too Much Damage documentary that Sci-Fi did about the rise of Image Comics, and I've known this for years. Though one of the ways in which you knew that Image was a big deal is when Rob Liefeld was doing a signing at a comic shop.
Yeah, guys from NWA showing up at Rob's signing.
The minute he walks in, I'm like, that's Eazy-E. Holy crap. He's coming to me. He's coming right to me. He's like, hey, Rob.
I didn't expect him to have a high-pitched voice like Michael Jackson did.
Hey, Rob, what's up, man? It's Eric. How you doing? And I was like, hi. And he's like,
yo, man, I'm a big fan, man. I'm buying all these Yungbluds.
And that was at the very earliest days of Image. So,
I knew he was big when he did a fucking Levi's commercial.
So how long have you been drawing comic books?
Since I was about 7 years old, little kid.
What'd your parents think about it?
They hated it. They hated it. Oh, yeah. After I got a job and they saw that you can make a living out of third, you'll hear no complaints anymore.
And you created X-Force?
Mm-hmm.
So what is the drawing of?
This is the Spike Man.
And what's this right here?
This is the camera on top of your head that will record the wrongdoings of others.
So Rob, have you had any formal art training?
No. Just a lot of imagination, I think. Wait till so I say it and then look down. Or just open it and say it.
Fly button?
Right. And me too. But yeah. Eazy-E, of course, was one of the first famous celebrities who was diagnosed with HIV.
Well, that's true. Yeah, that's true.
And so I know that they established Chapel.
Was way after the books, though.
Was it when that was revealed?
He was at the end of the 90s, yeah.
Was it that late?
Yeah.
Eazy-E has full-blown AIDS, according to a written statement released on Thursday. Eazy-E, whose real name is Eric Wright, was a founding member of the multi-million selling rap group NWA. He's currently in a critical condition in the intensive care ward of a Los Angeles hospital. The 31-year-old rapper had complained of breathing problems, but had no idea that he had AIDS before he was diagnosed 3 weeks ago. In a prepared written statement read by the rapper's publicist, Eazy-E, who's fathered 7 children with 6 different women, admitted to leading a fast life filled with, and I quote, fancy cars, gorgeous women, and good living. Eazy-E went on to say,
I heard a dope beat.
I'm not looking to blame anyone except myself. I feel that I've got thousands and thousands of young fans that have to learn about what's real when it comes to AIDS. I'd like to turn my own problem into something good that will reach out to all my homeboys and their kin because I want to save them before it's too late. I've learned in the last week that this thing is real and it doesn't discriminate. It affects everyone. How so many pray that I'll be just another failure? Eric Wright went onto life support on the 15th of March. He was under heavy sedation and unconscious at the time of his death. Towards the end of his life, the rapper received more than 2,500 calls a day from well-wishers and well-known members of the rap community. He leaves behind his wife Tamika and their 1-year-old son Dominic.
Eazy-E was born Eric Wright in 1963 in Compton, California. In 1986, he appeared in Dr. Dre, Ice Cube, DJ Yella, and MC Ren, and started Niggas With Attitude, or NWA, as well as Ruthless Records, a record label that was long rumored he started with money he made dealing with drugs, those claims never proved. In 1988, Eazy recorded 2 albums that launched him to stardom. Eazy Does It, the first of his 2 multi-platinum-selling solo albums, and with NWA, Straight Outta Compton.
Eazy is his name and the voice coming.
Straight Outta Compton! It's a brother that'll smother your mother. It makes your sister think I love her.
NWA altered hip-hop forever, expanding the popularity and heightening the edge of what would come to be known as gangster rap. Eazy claimed NWA was simply representing its hood.
I came from Compton. That's what I wanted to talk about, Compton. You had everybody from New York rapping about my Adidas and my chain, this and this, and South Bronx and everything. I wanted to put my city on the map. I'm from Compton.
Mirroring the tumult of its music, NWA quickly disintegrated into very public feuding, as first Ice Cube and later Dr. Dre jumped ship and dissed Eazy on their solo albums. Eazy dissed back on his 1993 single, Real Compton City G's.
All of a sudden, Dr. Dre is the key thing, but on his own album covers, he was the sheep thing.
We don't deal with Dre, because you know where he came from, world-class wrecking crew, so it's like that now, you know. We stay in sucker-free in 93.
Dre, Red, and Ren against Cube. Cube left the group first. After Cube left the group, then Dre left the group, Dr. Dre, which then left DJ Yella, Ren, and Eazy.
So, but Eazy had gone solo. He'd done solo projects before he left NWA.
But at that time, Eazy was also picking up other groups like, you know, Bone Thugs and Harmony. He'd gone from performing because he wasn't originally a performer.
Mm-hmm.
He was more like a money guy. And, you know, rumor always had that Ice Cube wrote a lot of his rhymes and stuff like that.
Okay.
And he just kind of fell into it. Because I still remember We Want Eazy video coming out and people like, you know, in my neighborhood losing their fucking minds. We had never seen anything like that. And I remember that because he's 13. I'm like, I remember people like, he's only 13. I'm like, really? Because you couldn't tell because he had this big ass clothes and he's in a jail cell. Their video camera, they're doing like a video conference from jail of Eazy-E and at a concert, and then he jumps through the screen. Trust me, man.
Okay, remember the timeline too. When was Straight Outta Compton versus Eazy Does It?
That I'm not sure. I'm real fuzzy on the time frame.
Because I want to say Easy Does It was 80, somewhere between 88 and 89. So I'm assuming the Straight Outta Compton was like around 87. I don't think my brother got NWA, or I don't think I remember him having the cassette, but I know he had Easy Does It because we used to listen to the shit out of Easy Does It.
You have to remember that at that time, dude, I wasn't just listening. I was listening to Easy E. I was in NWA, Too Short. I was listening to all that shit, dude. So it's kind of, let's see. And everybody talks about the movie, which apparently came out only 3 years ago. Here we go. 1988.
Was Easy Does It or
no, Straight Outta Compton?
Okay, so when was Easy Does It?
Let's see. Easy E, Soap. So he died in 95.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. But did we know he had HIV before he died? Was that
No, he died, and then we found out. Literally, they said he had a cough that would never go away. Mm-hmm. And then he went to the hospital with pneumonia. And then next thing you knew, he was in emergency care. And he went fast.
Yeah, see, I always wondered. Cause I thought that perhaps the Easy E connection was the reason why they did that with Chapel. But Chapel had already been revealed to have HIV before anybody knew about Easy E.
Yeah.
That's a weird thing, too, that he was a Youngblood fan. And then you have that parallel between him and Chapel.
Easy Does It, 1986.
Easy Does It with Easy Six? Mm-hmm. It was before?
It says NWO and Easy Does It, 1986 to 1991. NWO original lineup.
Well, no, but when did Easy Does It come out, though?
So it shows here that Easy E debut album, Easy Does It, came out in 1988. I'm sorry.
That fits my timeline then, mental timeline. Okay. I don't think the parallel stopped there, though, because obviously Easy E, though he definitely lived the gangster lifestyle.
Are we really going to go here? Okay.
Yeah. His persona in his raps was obviously a cartoon. Easy talked about all kinds of misogynistic and violent imagery that was there may have been aspects of that in his life, but it was blown up to cartoonish proportions in the reps.
You have to remember, dude, they were referred to as ghetto poets who were telling you the stories of the street.
But Easy E was always a cartoon. Easy E was not somebody. Easy E was not fucking Tupac and shit. You know, Easy was a comic book character himself.
The
character he portrayed in his music was not realistic.
No, he was.
He was from larger than life.
From my understanding, he was very much who you saw there. Like, that was who he was.
But inflated.
I'm sure. I mean, everyone grandstands in hip hop. Come on, dude. Not all of them owned fucking 50 Bentleys and
right.
Shit
well,
like that,
and I don't think he robbed any banks either. You know, no. But he definitely has a song about robbing a bank that's pretty detailed.
Trust me, if you've ever listened to NWA, trust me, it's there's some fucking really hardcore shit.
But Easy specifically of NWA was the most outsized in terms of what he portrayed in his music. He was so much bigger than life.
I don't know the dude, man. Don't know the dude.
Okay.
I only know through his music. I mean, for all I know, motherfucker was a serial killer. I mean, he definitely was killing pussy.
Point being is I do think that Rob Liefeld was an NWA fan. He recognized Easy as soon as he walked the door of the comic shop. And I do think that Chapel was the same sort of outlandish caricature of a badass type character. The 80s action stars, your Schwarzeneggers, your Stallones, you know, that kind of shit. And he made Chapel so much bigger and so much more ridiculous than even they were. So, like, he was doing the Rambo from the last Rambo movie, which was extraordinarily gory.
He basically stole the Punisher and just made the Punisher a serial killer.
That was the other thing I was going to say is I think what makes Chapel an interesting character, because it would be easy to say, oh, he's just Bushmaster writ large, or he's just like a Punisher type. The violence, the level of violence in Chapel stories are so outrageous. You said you looked at the 2-issue miniseries from the 90s.
Yeah.
It's so gory.
Yeah.
It really is like a fucking North Star.
And that's why Jay Lee's artwork was so perfect for it.
Yes. Now, it was Tom Tenney who did the two-parter, but it was Jay Lee doing the Youngblood Strike Files. Even in the stuff that isn't, like, where you're not actually seeing violence take place, there is a violence to Jay Lee's interpretation of the face and the body mannerisms. Like, there's a violence in his artwork.
He looks ghoulish. But even
when the characters are still, when they're just standing there talking,
everyone else looks normal.
There's just this implied violence in this guy. He seems like he's barely contained. It's like when Sienkiewicz would do his crazy characters in the early parts of the New Mutants run, a Legion character or something like that. There's just this implication of this guy just like barely containing his urge to rip human beings limb from limb. In terms of what I think that Eazy-E might have had an influence on Chapel, I think that fucking Bushwick Bill from Ghetto Boys, in terms of the imagery that he would convey in songs, like, what's the Chucky song he did back in the day?
There's a lot of them, though. I mean, my mind's playing tricks on me.
No, but I mean the Bushwick where he's actually pretending to be Chucky.
Probably called Chucky.
Yeah, where he's talking about murdering indiscriminately and in gory detail.
I told you silos and shit, that's why I murdered your nieces. Was my fault they find their head cut in 88 pieces. Don't let them run, hurry up and catch them. You grabbing on my grabbing on, let's pull till we stretch them. Play pussy, get fucked.
motherfuckers beware, cause I'm sick, dead heads and frog legs, cake mix.
I think what makes Chappell stand apart is that he owes as much to Michael Myers and Freddy Krueger and Jason Voorhees as he does to, and Leatherface especially, I think, because there's such a bone deep violence. It's like, it's never enough for him to just stab somebody. He's chopping off parts of their bodies. There's one scene in the two-parter where he chops a dude's head in half and it just explodes into gore. He really is a melding of the action, the canon action heroes of the 80s and the goriest of the horror characters from that same time period. He really does feel like one of the slashers,
yeah.
But then he's got a gun too, so his range is much wider. But he's scary.
He's a serial killer, dude. I mean,
he really is. He is like a serial killer who's also a mercenary. Because, I mean, he seems to just relish in that sort of, like, ultraviolence to the greatest extreme.
Yeah.
And, of course, he had a rapacious sexual appetite as well, so he really is this outrageous id monster.
Then he's very id-driven.
Very much. Jay Lee is not drawing a dude who has face paint on. He's drawing a demon from hell with fucking fangs and everything else.
What I was going to ask at that point was that... Well, never mind. No, I'm jumping ahead.
Jay Lee just... His work was downright impressionistic. It's like he definitely manifested the inherent violence of this character, and it was horrifying. It's not just about action. It's not even about gory action. This dude was pretty much a horror character because of how intense the representation was, not only by Jay Lee, but also by Tom Tenney. It's just really brutal, brutal action. But I wanted to read a little bit from a Jay Lee interview from Wizard Magazine number 21. Oddly enough, both Jay Lee and Rob Liefeld have interviews in this issue, so they both kind of reflect stuff from the Strike Files issues. And it's weird parallels too, because Rob Liefeld, before he broke big, was working on a B serial for Marvel Comics Presents. He only ended up doing the first two chapters before his duties on New Mutants pulled him away. And so Jay Lee ended up finishing that serial. And then he gets hired by Rob Liefeld to do another serial. It was originally supposed to be a pinup. He was going to do just a pinup for one of the issues of Youngblood. But once they decided to do the spinoff, it was originally going to be a 4-issue miniseries, Strike File. It ended up running a little bit longer than that. But he went from doing a pinup to doing another serial that Rob Liefeld was working on. And Liefeld did the front of the book and Jay Lee did the back. And that was a Chappell serial. He ran three installments, basically. And I like how in the interview, Jay Lee makes a point of saying that the Chappell story is a prelude to upcoming issues of Spawn, where we reveal who killed Spawn. And it's like, wow, this must have been the worst kept secret in comics, who killed Spawn, when it's part of the fucking advertising. Here in at the front of the Wizard issue is a 2-page spread, like a poster image. Why is this man smiling? And showing Chappell, and then in the background you've got Spawn's eyes. Find out in the prelude to Who Killed Spawn in Youngblood Strike File. And then there's another image of Chappell holding this ridiculous cartoon gun. I mean, it's got like this bizarro jagged blades on it, and God only knows what kind of caliber this thing is supposed to be firing. This doesn't exist in any kind of real life. This doesn't represent real life. This is obviously like a horrific caricature of action violent kind of bullshit. But I love that about it. Lee describes the Mercurial Liefeld's plots as being not unlike the man himself. Rob sent me a plot and it was very interesting. He has a lot of ideas and a lot of them are real exciting stuff that reflect his personality because he's always bouncing off the walls and his plots show that. He's just full of energy. Wizard asks about where his dark, almost geometric style comes from and Jay Lee laughs. It comes out of my soul. I'm just experimenting right now. I've been picking up different influences along the way. When I first started Namor, I was using a very design-oriented technique, probably because of my training as a commercial artist and design student. I was playing with geometric shapes, not a lot of detail, simply silhouettes and stuff. Then I got into Bill Sienkiewicz and Simon Bisley when I started inking my own material. That's when you can really expand on the techniques you use in penciling and try to adapt them to the ink stage. When you ink your own stuff, you have total control over that. It's true. My stuff has gotten a little too dark, perhaps. So much so that you really can't tell what's going on. Some of that has to do with the fact that I have to do this stuff really, really fast. I could range up to 8 pages a day, pencils and inks. Ideally, I want to do a page a day. I have recently quit Namor, and that relieves a lot of the monthly stress that I'm under. The projects I'm working on now all have long-term deadlines, and hopefully they'll let me turn out a page of my best work every day, working only an 8-hour day instead of 15 or 16 hours. He talks about, regrettably, I haven't had much experience outside the comics field. If I had time, I'd love to research other artists outside of comics. Sad to say, most of my influences are from within comics. There's a tendency to be derogatory about people whose influences are only in comics because it's felt that's it's too generic. In comics, in addition to Sienkiewicz and Bisley, there's also a little Larry Stroman and a lot of Mike Mignola. I'm trying to work a little Jay Lee in there too. When I started drawing at 13, I did a dead ringer of John Byrne stuff. It took me 8 years to shake that. Now I'm not trying to imitate anybody. I'm just trying to do what I like. And I really love Simon Bisley's work. So he talks about how he expects that he's going to come up with a character for Image eventually, but right now he's doing the work for Liefeld, and he was also getting ready to do some work for Jim Lee. He also talks about, I think the first issue of Strike Files shows that having a long deadline can be detrimental. I've had the plot about 3 months, and I'm still in the middle of it. It's definitely my best work, but at the same time, it's very stagnant. The characters don't seem to be jumping off the page. They seem to have an overworked quality, too studied, too controlled. Whereas some of my Namor stuff I've done was really pretty fast, as little as 4 or 5 days for an incomplete issue. But there was a sense of satisfaction because I was able to do it fast and still be happy with the way it turned out. I think I definitely need a deadline to get my butt moving. Otherwise, I won't do it until the last minute. And then he makes a joke about how he expects he's going to create a character for Image, and in 5 years, I want the character I create for Image to be on the 64th issue, and there will already be 2 or 3 movies out, and maybe a video game, which isn't how that shit panned out at all. So what did you think about the artwork in these issues?
I was good. I mean, it's very Jay Lee. I mean,
now, you were complaining that you didn't really like Jay Lee before.
I was never
you
a huge fan of his, no.
But you like the stuff in these issues?
No, I mean, it's fine. I mean, I've never been a huge fan of his. His style kind of reminds me of a Sam Keith, where it's pretty to look at, but it's at least Sam Keith is weird, where it's fun, where this was kind of the last thing I looked at. I mean, I'm trying to think of the last thing that I've read that Jay Lee drew was like G.I. Joe and the Transformers, which fit.
Jay Lee?
Yeah, he did the covers.
Oh, okay. I was about to say.
No, he didn't do interiors.
I don't imagine he would do the interiors.
No, he did
like
the covers.
Okay.
Which
that's
I
not,
like
that's
that.
Not a weird, that's a weird guy to have do something like that.
But he works really well with war. Like, his artwork to me is very angry and violent. I can't think of anything that he's ever done.
Which is why he's a perfect fit for Chapel.
Yeah. I mean, it looks good. I mean, it's just not in my bag. Like, I'm not a huge...
I really enjoyed the artwork in these issues. For me, Jay Lee, peak Jay Lee, was the very tail end of Namor, his few issues of X-Factor that he did, and these Youngblood Strike Files. Because it's just like him at his most... Again, he's edited Monster's Fage as well. It's super dark. It's overwrought in terms of like his rendering of the bodies. You really see the Simon Bisley influence especially. And I enjoyed that because as much as I like Simon Bisley, his stuff would be so rough sometimes. You could tell he just was hacking it out. Sometimes he was only going to invest so much of his time and energy into a page, but it also had that great rock and roll vibe to it, where Jay Lee seems like he took the time to figure out the design and the page layout, and his characters were more pristine, more precise, but also with that haywire energy to it, that frenetic energy to it. My favorite Jay Lee stuff. I think he became too self-conscious. I think that he became much more affected as he went on. I think he wanted to bring in more fine arts influences. You can hear it in this interview where he feels very self-conscious about having so many comic book influences and wanting to get away from that. But I just really enjoyed him as this raw comic book artist. And when he became more particular about what he drew and how he drew it and tried to bring in more fine arts influences, I didn't enjoy the work as much. Oh, it's so fucking violent. It's so fucking horrific. Now, you said you were surprised at how good the writing was, too.
Yes. It wasn't fucking Alan Moore level or anything, but I mean, it was more coherent than a lot of the other shit we've been reading from Blake. I mean, at least, you know, the story had a beginning, a middle, and an end, which was nice. It didn't feel like...
Yeah, Liefeld seems to have trouble actually finishing the stories. Yeah. He kind of starts in the middle, and then it sometimes just like
just
stops.
Peters out, or...
He loses
starts,
interest and jumps onto the next thing.
Going in another direction, so yeah.
And this one does still kind of do that, because it's like, now follow the further interests of Chaplin Bloodstrike. But you do feel a resolution there. You know that...
You've read it, you're fine with it. You know, you have a beginning, middle, end.
You were the only one I let in. I trusted you. Why?
You stupid son of a bitch. You were always the target. From the day we met, my job was to whack you when the time came.
And then we go into Spawn number 13. A little backstory on that book. This is released on August 30th, 1993. 2-0 Comics came out that same month, Extreme Zero and Stormwatch Zero. You had the Blood Brothers arc going on in Bloodstrike, and Brigade were already into their ongoing series at this point. Other ongoings at this point are Savage Dragon, Shaman's Tears, Super Patriot. That's a miniseries, though. Same goes for Union, I think. I don't think they'd started the ongoing on that one yet. The Max was already going, though, and Deathblow was already going. This issue came out around the same time as Youngblood Strike File number 3, so at least it does actually act as the prelude before we get into the Spawn material. The Spawn issue is Flashback Part 2. It's dedicated to George Perez. And what happens to that story?
Spawn decides that he, now that he remembers that Chapel killed him, he wants to get his hands on him. the book starts out with Bad Rock, no longer being referred to as Bedrock.
Okay, they've already, which is funny because just in the previous issue, they're like, nah, you guys, Hanna-Barbera can suck our dicks. And now this issue, you're like, oh, yeah, Bad Rock. I lost that suit.
One of many losses that McFarlane would be dealing with through his career.
Well, no, McFarlane didn't deal with that one. That was Liefeld getting sorry, a cease and desist and ultimately not being able to fight that shit.
Bad Rock is sitting there playing a video game.
Did the Image guys ever win a lawsuit? Like
maybe against each other, but I don't know, outside. So Bedrock's playing a video game. He rips it. Shaft walks in.
He rips the game. He accidentally breaks the game because he's so strong. Yeah,
yeah, and he's pissed off because he had been doing so well. And at this point...
Well, I think he was playtesting the Bad Rock game, wasn't he? Or was it the Shaft game?
No, it was Bad Rock game. Okay. I think so.
And that's right. Spawn, he wanted Shaft to play his own games because he wasn't... You know, he's like, you ought to check out your game, dude, or some shit like that.
Well, no. He says, my game is way better than your game.
Okay.
Apparently, his game was shitty. At this time, Spawn has... They didn't say if he teleported or not. He just, all of a sudden, he's inside the Youngbloods.
Well, that he was hiding out there for a few days, right? Waiting for Chapel to show up or something, or getting the lay of the land?
I don't think they really talk about that.
Okay.
It just shows him, because Bad Rock is playing, and you see Spawn's cape in the background floating around where he's walking around. At this time, Chapel and Die Hard are, I guess, in their version of the danger room where they're training. They tell Chapel, hey, man, those specialized... weapons have come in, and so Chapel's like, oh yeah, let's get this going. All of a sudden, Spawn appears and he confronts the whole team, and so they're all sitting there and they're ready to attack. You know, immediately Bad Rock comes running in. Spawn starts to do his little magic, the green globe comes, he vanishes, and everybody's like, wow, that was it. And that's when Bad Rock goes, did anyone else notice that Chapel's gone? And apparently nearly 8,000 miles from Youngblood headquarters lies a certain swamp in Botswana.
Okay, so that's Botswana. Africa, right?
Botswana. A green mist swirls there and informs. So, but before they teleport there, we're reintroduced to Terry waking up. He's under the pressure now. He's under the pressure that Jason Wynn has threatened his life or his family. So he's trying to figure out, I guess, his next play.
Well, and it's interesting too because you're looking at the Spawn cartoon versus the comic books. For the most part, they kind of did their own thing with the show. But these issues, the stuff with Terry and the stuff with Chapel, that's where the cartoon's doing a pretty close adaptation of what happened in the comics.
Well, so
remember, most of the second season of Spawn is Terry trying to deal with Wynn going after him, and they're basically this tug of war between whether or not Terry's going to survive revealing what Wynn's up to, and Wynn trying to fuck up his life and stuff, and all the tension that causes, and the tension that causes between Terry and Wanda as well.
So Wanda's kind of trying to console him and letting him know, you know, everything's going to be all right, but he's really concerned about his, you know, his family. Mm-hmm. I mean, because he's Jason Wynn. Terry, I guess, realizes that Jason Wynn really is dangerous. Yeah. Like, this is someone you can't take lightly.
Well, something they talked about, too, is in the earlier issues of Spawn, Wanda and Terry were both investigating what happened to Al.
Yeah.
It's probably what brought them together as a couple in the first place. And then they both had dropped it because they realized they were getting into weird conspiracy territory, and they thought they was, you know, maybe either they were afraid of going to those dark places, or they thought that maybe they were just being nutty and they
to drop it. Alex Jones!
Right. Now Terry's realizing, oh, shit, all that stuff we thought was going on is going on. Yeah. And now they know that we know, and
there are green lizard people. Oh no, frogs are being gay.
Which was on the soapbox now?
Yeah, no, but I'm not fucking raging against the machine. I'm just making fun of somebody. So then next we have Sam and Twitch, who are still under desk duty for Billy Kincaid's death. They're taking some lady's statement, and they're just kind of laughing and joking it off, you know. I guess just to let us know that they're still in the world. At this point, we are reintroduced to Spawn, who just teleported Chapel to
Botswana.
He starts throwing shit at him like, you killed me. You created me. The devil didn't really create me. You created me because you killed me. And, you know, Chapel's kind of like, motherfucker, I killed a lot of people. So, like, it's not a big deal. Like,
well, did he, in the comic book, did he believe that it was Al Simmons? Or
no,
like,
not until
you.
He tells them the Don Juan of killers.
Oh, yeah.
Once he calls them the...
Which they reference in the Paul Mayberry book, too.
That's why when I read that, I was like, oh, that's cute. That's a little nod to this one. But he calls them the Don Juan of killers, and then all of a sudden, Chapel's like, Al? And it kind of throws him off, because at the beginning, he thought it was another villain who was just throwing, like, shit at him.
Even, a little Fist of the Bizarre, actually. You know? He thought it was true, more of that shit.
Because he was talking about how Al's talking about something where you get the sense that Chapel felt it might have been Al, but it's not really Al. It's just somebody fucking with him.
Right.
And then, because he keeps talking about, like, you kill your friends as well as your enemies. And so Chapel's kind of whatever until he says the Don Juan of killers, which then all of a sudden, boom, hits the brakes on Chapel. And Chapel's like, oh shit, this shit's getting real. And decides to just kill him. And as Spawn is removing his cape, Chapel lunges at him. And Spawn starts to put the beating on that ass. And the whole time he's telling him, look, this is what you did to me. Rips off his mask. He's all barbecue, you know, he's all hamburger meat. And they're battling. Chapel's not scared. He's like, you know,
I've killed a lot of motherfuckers. Yeah, you're just going to be the next one. If I didn't kill you the first time, I'll kill you this time.
Pretty much, yeah. It's like, you're crazy. That one's for sure. It's going to be a pleasure breaking your scrawny neck. Let's end this now. And, of course, that's when he calls him the Don Juan of killers, which he freaks out. Now, once he hears that, he has a flashback of when he's with Jason Wynn. And Jason Wynn's telling him, hey, Al's a traitor. Take care of it. And he does what he's supposed to do. He's the perfect soldier. He goes and he takes care of the problem that has to be done. When the time comes, you casually load your laser pack, walk up to him, and fried his brains to a crisp. A job well done. Now get the word out. So apparently he shot him in the fucking head.
Right. Which is exactly what Al Simmons does to Duke in Youngblood Strike File. And see, I never picked up on Chapel having a problem with that. I didn't catch that. I think you mentioned it.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering if maybe Al killing Duke pissed off Chapel and was one of the reasons why Chapel was willing to kill off Al Simmons.
It didn't bother him. Well, but at this time, so then CNN is there, the same guy, but this time it's My View too. But the E reporter is now in front of a 7. So I'm assuming E sent them a letter to cease and desist using their logo.
Maybe he was on E back in the 80s and now he's at Channel 7, or maybe somebody just fucked up the background. Oh, you mean you thought that E sent Todd McFarlane a letter?
Same.
That's more, that may be a real deal.
I'm assuming that's what happened. Is like,
no, is there still a CNN logo, or is that gone too?
That's the weird thing. CNN. I'm assuming CNN, they're a huge organization. Yeah. So it's not, they deal with all kinds of weird shit where E Entertainment's not really wanting like
they're E Entertainment.
Yeah.
So it's like they are going to know comic books more than CNN's going to be bothered with comic books.
So I'm just, that's just a shot in the dark. I'm assuming here.
No pun intended.
And so they're battling. Chapel's not having a good time about this.
Well, he's way overpowered. Underpowered. Spawn's just got it all over. He's toying with Chapel.
I mean, there's one point where Chapel actually jams his fucked up looking
that ridiculous
Bowie knife
blade of his. Yeah.
His knife is so ridiculously weird. Jams into his chest.
Which really, again, the whole slasher aspect of the character. Yeah. It's like, why does he have these ridiculous knives? You know?
This weapon has no other purpose but to rip and tear and destroy. And Spawn basically just yanks it out of his chest like it's nothing and tells Chapel, you know, that's it. So Chapel's like, fuck it. Now, at this point, I want to believe, if I remember correctly, did he mention that he was HIV positive as well in this part? I want to say he did. They bring up the serum again. Maybe it's you, and maybe it's not. Never could stomach that you're whining all the time, trying to fix everything. You're always a goody two-shoes. It was me who took the serum, not you. I'm the one that's poisoned with HIV. So screw your sob story.
Which is a kind of a continuity error, too, because the way Wynn says it, you're already out of Youngblood before you walk out of his office. Yeah. But here he's back hanging out with Youngblood like it's no big deal.
Yeah, no, you're right. Spawn yanks it up. Yanks the fucking Bowie knife out of his chest like no big deal. They're battling, and I think at one point Spawn's like, you know what, I'm not gonna kill you. Even Chapel's like, well, just fucking end me. And he's like, I'm not gonna kill you. He goes, at one point he mentioned to him that he had removed the tracker from Chapel so his friends couldn't find him.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically touches Chapel's face, and let's be honest, he basically burns the skull into Chapel's face.
Yeah, so he really does have a skull.
Yeah, so
he's gonna have a lot more trouble being the Don Juan of killers now that he's got a fucking skull face.
Well, I guess he wants him to match what he the perception he was throwing out, I guess he wants him now to fulfill burning his face off.
You're the evil and darkness in your soul
even
is now overt.
Teeth, yeah, even his teeth. I mean, everything. I mean, he's grotesque. He turns on his tracker so that Youngblood can come get him. And apparently he's holding one of Spawn's.
Now, he burned off his nose too, right?
Yeah. No, his nose is still there.
He's still got the nose?
Yeah.
Okay, weird.
It would have been kind of cool to burn off the nose though.
Right?
But you could see where the flesh. Wow, that's really weird. Yeah, he should have burned off his nose because he has a full nose on there. But you can see where the flesh is removed. So I guess he just removed like a layer of the flesh, kind of like the Joker did in the DC books.
The face.
Well, no, I think kind of like the DC books where the Joker just cut off his face and removed it, and it's just like a red bloody slab.
So the white of his nose is cartilage, you think?
Fucking dude, it's a fucking image book, man.
I'm thinking too hard about this.
Yeah,
apparently.
Dude, you're fucking giving him way too much credit. Anatomy, come on, it's Layfield. Let's be real now. No feet.
Well, he definitely removed the lips because he's got real fucking fangs that don't go away. Yeah.
And so I guess, which kind of bothered me, and I'm pretty sure somewhere in there Al threatened him, but why would you fuck with a mad dog killer? He figures out who you are. And then you leave him knowing that he's probably going to go after the woman you love and her
own
family.
You think he's
going to
go? Yeah.
Yeah, like that's...
Well, it's funny, though. He never does, though.
That's just to me again.
Because I mean, Chappell seems like the kind of guy who would do that. He was the guy who killed Al Simmons.
To me, that just tells me then whoever wrote him after that didn't know the character. Like, they're using the character more to just fill the story than the story being created because of the character.
Well, I think it might be part of it too is that he basically got deferred over to Bloodstrike, and most of the rest of his comics career was spent over at Bloodstrike in that time period.
Maybe he didn't have
the freedom to go do that.
No, Chappell seems like the kind of guy that if he was left alone like that, he would be doing research. He would be fucking killing people to find out how can I kill with this? What is this and how do I kill it?
Right.
What do I need to do to kill it?
How do I kill this hellspawn thing? Yeah.
Once I find out how to kill it, then I'm going to go fuck with its family. So when it fight next time we fight, I can kill it.
So it's dumb of Al Simmons to leave this guy alive because he's definitely an ongoing threat to his family.
Yeah.
It never ends up coming up though because he's going in a different path. I don't want to spoil anything though because we're going to come back to Chappell later on.
I think the writers were just like, they used him basically as a fucking tool to get the story moving along. I don't believe if Chappell is such a badass. I mean, look at Geiger. Dude, I mean, the dude's a fucking killing machine.
Yeah.
Like, he went after Chappell. Geiger.
Fuck you. I'm going to kill your shit. Yeah.
I don't see him as the type of character to be like, well, he let me live. I let live. I guess that's okay. Yeah. I think he would take offense that you just fucked up my face.
Right.
I'm the Don Juan of killers. You just fucked up my action. And this is kind of a deep cut. But if you've ever seen Street Fighter the video game, there's a scene where Vega and Chun Li are fighting, and Vega in the video game is a very vain character. He's so beautiful. I'm so beautiful. And they're battling, and there's a scene where she steps on his face, spins her foot around, and destroys his face, and he loses his shit to the point where he no longer knows how to fight. He's lost it.
Is this in the video game?
No, this is in a movie.
Okay.
A cartoon or anime based on the video game.
Oh, okay.
But to me, that's the kind of mindset that happens. Is someone who's so vain, when you take away the one thing that they're so vain about, they're just going to lose their shit because that was their power. That was them.
Well, that's Jigsaw's origin. From the Punisher, one of the Punisher's main villains, Jigsaw. Yeah, that's his origin. Yeah. Yeah.
So to me, the way they wrote him, I thought it was just a complete loss, like a waste. Like, you got this potentially good story arc coming up because you just created this character who's extremely vain, who fucks women because that fills the hole in his soul. Yeah. And guess what? We removed his face and he's okay with that.
Well, and what you mentioned too, maybe this was the inspiration of it. You've always talked about how you used to read Bloodstrike and you were very interested in the story arc where people who've been revived by that program can give you super venereal diseases and stuff.
Yeah, I just thought that was so fucking weird. Like, okay. Yeah.
But Chappell has HIV and he was a known womanizer. And that's not something that I don't think they ever addressed in the comic books after the point where they reveal he had HIV. I don't remember him having any sort of relations with anybody at that point. So if he's such a psycho, sociopathic, murderous type person, he doesn't actually go after women, which I think is a good thing. It's like, I don't want to deal with the story where he's intentionally infecting people with HIV. Yeah. But I also wonder if maybe that's something that Giffen wanted to explore and he didn't because maybe he was restricted or he thought he was going to be too much bad taste. So maybe he was inspired by the HIV to do that story in Bloodstrike where he found a different angle on it where it wasn't as offensive as it could have been.
Who knows? I mean, they never got to...
Yeah, because he wasn't in Bloodstrike for very long, right?
No.
Just a few months, I think.
And they never really finished that arc, so
they did finish it, though.
Oh, did they?
That's the... Bloodstrike Brutalist wraps up that arc.
Okay, good, because I need to read that thing.
Yeah, we'll get there.
I think I brought that up to you a long time ago.
It's come up numerous times, yeah. But I saw a connection here with Chappell. I remember there was a criticism among scholars of African-American characters in the comic books, where there was this period where if you had a black villain who had a weird physical manifestation, like Black Manta, you know, this guy wears the big domed helmet and everything else. And so then at one point they ended up turning him into like this mutant Black Manta guy. There was a lot of African-American characters in comic books, like Killer Croc is another example, where they were deformed. And the scholars were seeing that as a means of dehumanizing these African-American characters. They couldn't be just black. They had to be black and deformed and shit. There was this tendency to internalize powers in comics. It used to be you'd have superheroes be introduced with a device. Black Lightning would be a good example. His powers were he wore a belt that was a battery pack, and it basically turned him into a human taser where he could touch you and zap you, and he could actually project electricity. But it was all on his belt. And then later on, they made it to where he had that power as part of his person. And what ended up happening is that more characters of other races ended up having that done to them too. So instead of it being a black-centric thing, it ended up just being a comic book thing where fewer and fewer characters were gadget-based and more just internalized the power. Fewer characters affected being deformed, like Red Skull being an example, where he wore a mask for most of his first 40 or 50 years of his career. And then he eventually got exposed to his bullshit rip-off Joker venom, the Red Skull dust or whatever it was called. And he actually had a red skull from that point onward. So it was less of a problem once it wasn't about dehumanizing black characters and it just became, you know, taking characters that pretended to be something and actually gave them the powers, gave them the deformities. But this is another instance of that happening where Chappell painted a face on and then it became an actual skull face. And what's interesting is the same thing happened to Bushmaster in Moonlight Comics when they brought him back and David Finch was doing it. I think at some point his face gets carved off and he actually does have a visible skull. So it's just another weird little parallel there. But it was actually done with Chappell first. And that was an instance where Bushmaster rips off Chappell in reverse. So what did you think of the story though?
It was okay. I mean, it's, I want to say they set up, it felt like a setup that never paid off.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, we know Chappell killed Al and I'll let him live because like it created more questions than answers.
Yeah.
So I was kind of like, okay, you gave me one issue that was all about reintroducing the character to the readers already or new people climbing, you know, a starting point for new people. Okay. And then you're going to throw this at us and then just kind of move on to something else.
Yeah.
It just,
yeah.
Not very,
this key aspect of the origins of this character and you build up to this being this big mystery. It's not a mystery. We talked about this in the last episode. They did nothing to give you any evidence of who killed Spawn. They never really even played it as a mystery. They just like, we're not telling you who killed Spawn. And then all of a sudden in issue 12, they tell you it's Chappell. And it's like, that should have been like a 6-issue arc of them slowly building up to giving you like a list of suspects. And
I'll give you the one here. After Chappell survives, he starts hunting down the Spawn mythology, figuring out how to kill a Spawn.
Right, but no, I'm not talking about the follow-up. I'm talking about before they even reveal.
Just a build-up?
Yeah, give us like a list of suspects.
Oh, yeah.
You know, get Terry on there, get, you know, some of these other side characters.
Shaft,
sure, whatever.
Die Hard.
Well, maybe not. Like maybe one of the members of Operation Nightstrike killed him or something, and so that we get a sense of who these guys are, and build up to the reveal, and so make that a story. And instead, I think there was a situation where Todd knew that Rob was telling a story with Chappell. And he knew that he had so much time to get his part of the story out because they were going to resolve what they were doing with Chappell. And so it just got rushed. And I think they decided early on, my guy killed your guy and it'll be so cool and it'll help set up our universe. And then Rob, of course, had a billion different ideas in the meantime and decided, oh, I want to do this. And so they had to hurry up and just tell that story real quick instead of giving it a chance to actually build up to it and make it a big reveal, make it a big surprise, be like, oh my God, it's Chappell. And then, as you said, then doing something with it afterwards. And instead, we got kind of a rushed conclusion that we'll address later on,
yeah.
Once we explore Chappell further. But we've got a lot of Chappell stuff to deal with before then, so I don't want to get too much into that. Chappell was in the cartoon. We've talked about that some. I think that it was a pretty decent representation of the character in the cartoon. Sometimes I prefer the character as presented in the cartoon, but I really hated how they resolved the Chappell arc in the cartoon as well. Do you remember what happened with that?
No.
So the second episode of the second season, after having Chappell in the background all throughout the first season and building up what a scary, evil badass he is, and they also did a really good job of showing these flashbacks to Al Simmons when he was alive and showing what a psycho Chappell was, even though they're supposed to be best friends. And then the second episode of the second season, Spawn and Chappell have a confrontation. Spawn kicks the shit out of Chappell, and then he uses a penance stare, which he ripped off from Ghost Rider, to drive Chappell insane. And the rest of the series, he's just a crazy person who's locked up in the jail in New York.
Arkham.
No, he's in New York. Well, no, they send him to Bellevue. Ultimately, he ends up in Bellevue. But first, Sam and Twitch are trying to find out what he knows, and he's just like a babbling psychopath. The rain has washed off his skull. And then he turns up one more time on the second episode of the third season where he's at Bellevue. He's in chains. He's interviewed by Twitch Williams, who gives him a key bit of information that allows Twitch to go after Spawn. But Chappell's just like, I kicked your ass. You know, Spawn kicked his ass, drove him insane, and that's all that we see from Chappell from then on. We never get some kind of cool fight. We never get to see him going after Spawn in the future. And I'm wondering, too, I assume that Liefeld signed off on Chappell appearing in the Spawn cartoon years before that happened, because it takes so long to get things done in animation. By the time the TV show was ongoing, Liefeld had his falling out with the Image guys, had quit Image, was no longer a founder, and went off to do his own comics with his own company. So obviously, Todd and Rob had a big falling out. I'm not sure if they ever really reconciled from that. Because the live-action movie went into production later than the cartoon, there is no Chappell in the live-action movie, and they ended up having to come up with a new person to have killed Spawn for the movie.
Female assassin, right?
Yeah, and we'll address that later on. And so I guess because they wanted to diminish Chappell's role, so that's why they got him out of the series really quickly early in the second season, and then for the most part left him alone from then on. And I think that's a real shame, because I think that Chappell was being built up as being a really the nemesis of Spawn, and instead he just got dropped and walked away from it. So this is an instance where attempting to do a shared universe and a creator-owned line, and this happens throughout the Image comics, that attempts at interconnectivity bites bites them on the ass over and over again.
Let me ask you, does the series at least have a finale or an ending? Or
I haven't finished the third season yet. Yeah, I was watching it specifically for Chapel. I'm a little bit short of finishing up the series, and we don't have time to talk about it in this episode anyway.
I'm just curious.
So I've got four more episodes.
Where it just like ended.
Kinda, I think. I kind of know how it ends because I did a little bit of reading because I was trying to find out how much Angela turns up. And of course, Angela got disappeared even faster than Chapel did by far. So, yeah, I think it just sort of ends to some degree. There's some sort of resolution, but not probably a satisfying one. But we'll get to that when we talk about the cartoon in greater detail. But I really do like the Chapel character. I do like what he represents. I do think that he's a unique presence despite obvious influences. He has a unique energy and a unique presence in the comics. And I think he is one of the defining image characters, and obviously he has a lot to do with the Image universe as a whole. And I just like how proactive he is too. I get so tired of Spawn's passivity. He's just so sitting there and not doing anything. He's so reactionary, and I just like that Chapel's just like, point me and I will fucking kill the shit out of whoever you point me at. And even though his adventures are really much, I mean, his stories, his solo stories, I couldn't read it too much because he's just so fucking dark. He's so fucking evil. But he is interesting. He's much more interesting of a character than Spawn's been so far. It's a great visual, and he's just such a scary motherfucker, especially when somebody like Jay Lee or Tom Taney are doing him. When I look at those Jay Lee images, there is a twinge of horror. I'm kind of spooked by this guy because he's so fucking intense. So I respect that they were able to bring that out, because I'm an old school gore hound, man. I've watched all kinds of horror movies and I've seen all kinds of slasher stuff, and there's just something about his representation in the comics, him being so violent, possibly because he's violent in a genre that you're not used to having that level of ultra violence. He's like an action character and a superhero character, and he just goes fucking so far off the rails into North Star territory. It's like, whoa, shit, man, calm fucking down, you're scaring the shit out of me because you're so much. But I also like him and I respect him for that.
Okay, and just so you know, I'm going to change my name now to Bushmaster. That is the greatest name. I am now Señor Bushmaster.
Our spawning partners include the 108th Sage, All the Pouches and Image Comics Podcast, The Bat Boy, Bud Winkle, Chris at Bat Books for Beginners, Class 1000, a Marvel Superheroes Live RPG, Coffee and Comics Podcast, Dr. G Nerdologist, Ed Moore, Fanholes Podcast, Geekery with Dante D, Giddy, Killjoy Gus, Greek God, The Hammer Strikes, Random Geeky Stuff, History of Comics on Film, The Hoopers, Jared Albrecht, the Yard Sale Artist, Jeffrey Brown, Jennifer DeRoss, Justice First Dawn, Kyle Benning Likes Comics, Keith G. Baker, Christados, Longbox Crusade, Lost in Time, Man Braid Podcast, Max Romero, Merch, Nethead, Odell Abner Dracula, Quentin Beck, Rad Adventures Podcasting Network, Resurrections and Adam Warlock and Thanos Podcast, Richard Field, Ryan Daly, Sean Michael Ortega, Secret Wars and Beyond Podcast, Sean Phillips, Siskoid, Slangward Scott, Steve Sellers, Superhero Network, Tim Price, Tiny Robot Z, and Varangian Vigilante. Nethead let folks know that he's listening to Spawnometer Episode 12, Cyberforce via Downcast app. Odell Abner Dracula wrote regarding Cyberforce, "I never read this title, but sometimes it's good to hear something is exactly what it appears to be. Looking forward to hearing you guys discuss more issues I haven't read. Spawn number 12 was where I finally bailed in 93. John Wilson over at All the Pouches wrote, "I love how this reveal was seeded all the way back in the first issue, when Chapel existed a lot more as an idea in conversations and interviews than as an actual published comic character. McFarlane decided to use him for this." Jeffrey Brown wrote, "I had this issue of Spawn and I remember reading into the flashbacks of Spawn, realizing that it was Chapel who killed him, and also watching the animated series on DVD at the time. I mostly know of Chapel from Spawn. In 08-09, when I was buying back issues of early Image books, Chapel to me was a bit of a curiosity. Maybe it was his design with the painted skull on his face, but what bugged me was his military gear in the comics as depicted by Liefeld, Lee, and McFarlane always changed. And I also wonder why McFarlane wanted to draw Chapel's face with monster teeth, and Liefeld at first didn't, but later adapted what McFarlane did on his Youngblood run. I know Jay Lee also drew Chapel's face with demonic teeth in Youngblood Strike File, but in the animated series, I like how they just gave him regular military guns and ammo. But what gets me about Chapel is that what was Rob Liefeld's inspiration for creating, and what Todd saw in the character to give him this connection to Spawn slash Al? Yep, and to this day, this is why Chapel has always been a curiosity. I will admit he looked cool. Shame he was never in the Spawn movie. Or if Youngblood would have appeared in the 95 Wildcats cartoon, if they would have adapted the first four issues, I felt like Jim Lee drew him better. Finally, Ryan Daly replied to my open request for help talking about Wetworks. I don't have access to the issues, but I was a big fan. Would have to talk about it from memory.
In 2008, 2011, the irredeemable Shag and Aqua Rob Kelly teamed up to create the Fire & Water podcast. In 2016, they teamed up with Ryan Daly, The Franklins, and Siskoid to form the Fire & Water Podcast Network. A network built on teaming up needs a show about team-ups.
Marvel Team-Up.
Yes.
The Brave and the Bold?
You know it.
Marvel 2-in-1.
It's clobbering time.
DC Comics presents.
Of course.
Supervillain Team-Up?
Good idea.
Youngblood X-Force?
Technically. FW Team Up, coming this summer, only from the Fire & Water Podcast Network.
Hello everyone, I'm Al Sedano, host of Resurrections and Adam Warlock and Thanos Podcast. Over the last few years, this show has covered Adam's life. From his early appearances in Fantastic Four and Thor, to his run as Space Jesus on Counter-Earth. Now, we have made it midway through the 1970s and Jim Starlin's iconic run on the character. The Magus, Gamora, Pip the Troll, and Adam finally meeting Thanos. Speaking of Thanos, we haven't forgotten about him. We will soon be starting our coverage of Starlin's hardcover graphic novel, The Infinity Relativity, starring Thanos. So join me, along with my regular co-hosts, John Wilson and Brian Zeno, as well as others, on Resurrections and Adam Warlock and Thanos Podcast. Found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. ResurrectionsAdamWarlock.tumblr.com.
All right, you guys want to hear my song?
I'm in the middle of this parking lot, and I just start dancing. Next phase, new
way, dance great. It's probably my favorite song of all. Roll at every station,
wreck the DJ. Welcome to One Song Each.
We're going to take a few minutes to talk about a song.
Choose without consulting the others, and we play the song and then comment with a story, an anecdote.
The artist's career overall, particular album.
The actual meaning of the song or more history, what it triggers in your memory or stuff like that.
I'll interject some factoids about the song.
We're going to talk about one song.
The B-sides will be with a variety of guests.
It sort of became our song.
You can either be technical or more intimate.
At least let me get drunk to enjoy the song. Like, you can't play it while we're sober. That's not fair. Do you like
good music? That's one song each.
This is a Roll Twine podcast.
This is a fan-produced, not-for-profit podcast. No copyright infringement is intended, and any use of copyrighted materials believed to be covered under fair use. If you don't agree, you can go straight to hell!
At this time, do we realize that he's HIV positive?
We're going to get to that. Okay. Dude, shut up. That's not even in the cartoon, man. I actually
talk. I don't know if it's in the
cartoon. In the cartoon. Don't bring
just
it up
in the
yet.
Comics?
Yes, don't bring that up yet.
Okay.
That's not even in the cartoon.
I didn't know that.
Okay.
Be such a little bitch about
no,
it.
No, because that's a big reveal. That's one of the things we're going to talk about.
In the
comic books, they never do that in the cartoon,
dude, they
man.
Did it at 13. Okay, go.
I don't think it's in issue 13, is it?
Yes, it is.
Okay, well.
He literally tells him, I drank the potion, you
okay,
didn't.
Okay, stop. We're going to talk about, we're building up okay. to 13, dude. Fucking, don't bring up the issue. Okay, so how's he introduced the cartoon?